Get ready.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to the Weekly Cooldown. I am Kami Jace, your host.
And I'm Paul Henderson, your semi-regular guestish host.
And if you're joining us for the first time, this is the show where we get to know the gaming news of the week, and we get to know our guest. It is episode 127 of the Weekly Cooldown. It is May 14th. We are going to get into these headlines, and we're going to get to our guest, who is patiently waiting for us to wrap it up here. So, I will take the first one. Paul, lead after me. Here we go. Respawn is warning players not to take advantage of a Season 9 Apex Legends bug that allows players to clip inside of a rock and block all incoming damage. The rock in question is found on the Phase Runner map, one of four new maps in the Arenas mode. A fix for the bug is underway and was supposed to be online this week, but is still being worked on by Respawn. Respawn has stated that any further abuse of this exploit will be considered a bannable offense.
Players eager to give Square Enix's Final Fantasy-based Battle Royale a try will be able to sign up for the closed beta. Final Fantasy VII, The First Soldier, will be entering closed beta in June, with signups happening right now until May 27th at 8 a.m. Pacific time. You got about 12, 15 days, something like that. The game looks to be accessible on only on smartphones at the moment, and unfortunately for Apple and iOS users, it is only available so far on the Google Play Store for Android users. Again, the closed beta play period for Final Fantasy VII, The First Soldier, will be from June 1st to June 7th, with signups happening right now.
In other mobile game news, you can also pre-register for Nier Reincarnation on both Android and iOS this week. In this case, pre-registration is not access to a closed beta testing, at least not for Android users. Square Enix has said that there should be a closed beta test for Android users coming soon. If pre-registration can reach up to 300,000 in North America, Europe, and Korea, players will be gifted launch day gifts such as 3,000 gems, which can be exchanged for abilities and summons. There seem to be gacha-like elements to the game, such as summoning allies in exchange for currency.
Remedy is teasing a quote-unquote new and exciting early phase project, end quote, according to its latest business update. During the business review, CEO Taro Vitala said that work on the AAA multi-platform game and a free-to-play co-op project, currently named Vanguard, are coming along well. The studio is also behind the single-player campaigns for Crossfire X and Crossfire HD. Earlier this year, creative director Sam Lake said last year that the studio is working on a game that works within the, quote, Remedy-connected universe. But there seems to be no confirmation that that game, whatever it is connected to the same games Vertala was speaking on.
And finally, Black video game pioneer Jerry Lawson will have his name adorned on a new endowment being offered to Black and Indigenous students enrolled in the University of Southern California's USC Games program. Take-Two Interactive has signed on as the first industry partner. The award is known as the Gerald A. Lawson Endowment Fund. Lawson was an engineer who developed a game console known as the Fairchild Channel F, as well as other games including an arcade stand-up game called Demolition Derby. He was also a part of a hobbyist group called the Homebrew Computer Club, which included other members such as Steve Jobs and Adam Osborne.
And one more thing that's not on there, he was one of the head engineers that helped create the modern commercial video game cartridge.
That is very true.
Big deal. Most
certainly was. And those are your headlines. You remember them. They were good headlines. And if you have anything you want to talk about otherwise, You know where to find us on Twitter. I'm at ComicJaceGaming or
I'm currently
at WKCooldown.
And I'm currently privated, but if you hit me up at Paul's Rockin' Twit, hopefully in the next week or two I will be public again. You can also just request a follow. That's fine. Hit me up.
Yeah. Request to follow. So we've got a guest here who has just been super, super great so far.
I thought I was the only guest.
No, never.
Wow.
Not anymore.
Oh, no.
Sorry. Once you become a co-host, you're just like a co-host.
What have I signed up for? Hold on.
You're not special anymore. We have a guest here. First time on the podcast. Yay.
Yeah.
They have a podcast themselves. We're going to introduce him. His name is Christian.
Hello. Yeah, I am Christian Skipper. I'm the host and founder of the Franchise Festival podcast.
And what, pray tell, is the Franchise Festival podcast?
Yeah, good question. I started it with a few co-hosts last year, January 2021. And it is we sort of go in depth over a long period of time on a given series. So for season one, we covered The Legend of Zelda entry by entry. And we're going to be wrapping that up in, I guess, about a month or so at the time of recording and moving on to Resident Evil for season two, beginning in July 2021.
So this is almost like the prestige video game review podcast of sorts.
Yeah, you know, in a lot of ways it is. I'm a history guy by nature, so my particular angle on it is kind of the history of how these got made and what their kind of place in the culture is and the conversation. But my co-hosts are more kind of gameplay or plot oriented. So we all kind of come together and create a nice alchemy there.
So it sounds like maybe you're more interested in like the historical like context of it, and they're more focused on the sort of experience of what it's like to just be playing those games, kind of.
You have nailed it just perfectly. That's
bingo.
Just how it is, isn't
bingo.
It?
Bingo, ha ta ta.
Yeah,
it's like you listened to the podcast.
Nope. Yeah, it's a hoot and a half.
I haven't. I'm listening. I'm using context clues, Comic Jace. How fucking
You're
dare
great.
You? Why would I ever research a guest that we've had on this podcast?
Why would you listen?
That takes
to
time.
Very
that sounds
good,
awesome,
good.
Honestly. I might
it does
it
sound
out.
Very good. Yes, I like that you're kind of attacking at all angles. You're taking it bit by bit. And there's sounds like it's something in it for everyone, right?
Exactly.
The history, yeah. The plot, the gameplay. Everyone gets something out of it.
Kind of makes you think of the YouTube series Boss Keys. I don't know if either of you have watched that or not.
Yes, that's a key reference.
Oh,
we have a website and we cite all our sources. Again, history guy here. So, you know, we cite all of our sources, and Boss Keys is inevitably a pretty consistent link on our website. That
hey.
Mark Brown really knows what's what.
So I want to point out that you made two very good puns in those couple of sentences that you made. You said that it was a key reference and that you said that there were a lot of links. Legend of Zelda.
I so wish that was intentional.
You know what?
So wish that was intentional.
I'll embrace them for you.
That's what Paul's here for.
Nice. Any other projects you're working on besides that? Maybe like smaller stuff or just something that's just you're really passionate about?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been writing for the website The Avocado for some time. It was sort of an unofficial spinoff of The AV Club. Very unofficial, to be clear. No professional association with The AV Club. But I've been writing for them for some time. And this year, I've been running a series of interviews with indie game developers. So over the last 2 months, I run those on the first of every month, and that website is the-avocado.org. But the last 2 months, I interviewed Kaizen Gameworks, who made Paradise Killer last year, as well as Radical Fish, who made Crosscode a few years back. So lots of good indie content on there. Really good insights from those developers. They've been very generous with their time.
That's awesome.
Paradise Killer was one of those games that hyped everyone up when they saw it revealed.
Yeah.
I think it was at like PC Game Show.
Yeah, this game.
It was hyped up as kind of like a whodunit, but also like a dating sim.
It's wild.
Yeah.
There's not like it.
All neon colors and good character designs.
Yes, and so I'm slightly jealous that you got to speak to this person.
That's pretty awesome.
Very cool, very cool. That is the avocado. I will have to slide them my resume and see if I could do some writing as well.
Oh, yeah, good bunch of folks over there.
Very good. So we have to ask you the age-old question, the question we've been asking for 120-some-odd episodes. What have you been playing this week?
I have been splitting my time between two first-person games, which control so differently as to make the transition kind of awkward. The first is New Pokemon Snap.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
As you should.
Yeah, I can't put that down. It's I really thought, you know, I'm an old timer, I guess, in some ways. And so I remember when the original Pokemon Snap came out and I could put that down because it was about 4 hours long.
Right. Sure. You would put it up and then you put it back down, having completed it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But this one, it is packed to the gills with content.
Wow.
And so I've just been running through those courses again and again, and I just can't get enough of those little pocket monsters.
Did you ever, when you were younger, did you ever get to go to Blockbuster and get printouts of your Pokemon Snap stuff?
Oh. No, and I regret it to this day.
Same.
I've never seen one of those machines.
100%. I did, and I wanted to so badly, but I had no idea how to, like, even try and conceptualize what was happening because I was too young. Yeah. So, like, I couldn't figure out. First of all, we didn't actually have Pokemon Snap. We had Pokemon Snap at the daycare that I was at, so I played it there. And so I saw those machines, and I was like, holy fuck, there's some cool stuff happening here. Anyway.
so cool.
And your second first-person game.
Yeah, Resident Evil Village.
Of course. You're not kidding about those two being a little contrasting.
Yeah.
They are an exercise in contrasts, yes. from tone to controls, they're a tough fit with one another, but both a lot of fun. I was really afraid of spoilers with Resident Evil Village. As you can tell from my plug for season two of my show, Resident Evil is something of a fond franchise for me, and right on, it's so great. And, like, they went kind of through a dark period, and it's come back out the other side, and it's good again. So, I was really pumped for this to come out and really afraid of spoilers with all the press coming out saying, you know, there's some real strange twists here. So, you know, I blew through it entirely this past weekend.
I just decided, like, I have enough money in my budget to go and get it on sale through Green Man Gaming.
Nice.
Which brought it down from 60 to a modest 50. And I still have not actually touched it yet. So I'm still actively dodging every single spoiler that I can because I just have not had a chance to actually play the game. So it's very scary that I've seen like glimpses of things here and there. And I'm like,
yeah,
it's like the, you know, like a curse. You're like, no, don't look at it.
Right.
Nice.
Very good.
All right. I think I'm going to go ahead and go next. So,
yeah,
what have I been playing? Well, first of all, of course, I have been streaming, actually. I've been streaming Resident Evil 8 on twitch.tv/Bondi77. Don't forget to like and subscribe and follow. And I'm going to be honest. I started the streams unspoiled. And then I got through, like, the first main act. I got through I beat the first major boss of the game. And then I was like, I am so stressed out. So, a little fun Paul secret. I don't like horror, like, generally speaking. Resident Evil 7 was a weird exception for me. Because when I saw footage of Resident Evil 7 and I learned some stuff about what it was about, I had a moment where I was like, oh, wait a minute. This is extremely my shit. I don't get this at all. And I played through the intro of Resident Evil 7, I was like, okay, this is a fucking mistake. and then I pushed through it, and I was like, okay, this is actually amazing. Mm-hmm. And I ended up liking Resident Evil 7 so much that I actually went back and streamed the whole game in VR.
Wow.
Which
I do remember that. Yeah.
I've heard anecdotally from multiple people that Resident Evil 7 is too intense of a game to play through in VR, and I get it. Like, I fucking get it. There's a clip of me on Twitch somewhere, which is still one of my favorite clips, which is one of the early scenes in the game where Mia basically runs at you with a knife and starts stabbing the shit out of you, and like she stabs your hand and starts stabbing at your face, and I physically ripped the headset off my face and stopped playing the game. It was that intense for me, and I borderline had like a flashback whenever I came back to that part of the game during my full playthrough that I did on Twitch. Actually, I did a part of it on YouTube, but also on Twitch. And so having beaten that, I was like, well, fuck, when Resident Evil 8 comes out, I'm going to have to play it. And so I actually bought it a couple days ago, and I'm not going to go too far into it, but there's a moment that happens, or there's a section of the game that happens not too far after the first boss, and it kind of pushed me to my limit. That was the point where I was like, okay, fuck this. I in the middle of the Twitch stream, mind, I ran to the bathroom, pulled out my phone, and basically like looked up what happened for the rest of the game because I was like losing my fucking mind.
Yeah.
And so I did like a 5-minute download on like everything that happens just so I could have a little point by point. Okay, this is what happens, this is what happens, this is what happens, be ready for it. And then I went back and I kept playing the game. And specifically, there's a monster that appears. I'm not going to go too far into it, but there's a monster that appears. And I actually, before the monster showed up, I had to look it up because there were lockers that were appearing. And I was like, oh, this is going to be like an Alien Isolation situation. Which, by the way, I have not played Alien Isolation. I'm never going to play Alien Isolation, but I know all of Alien Isolation's deal, and I can't touch that shit. And
it's so, like, very scary.
And so those same edges of like why I can't play that game started kicking in, and I was like, oh no, I can't fucking do this. Anyway, Resident Evil Village is fucking good, and I can't wait to beat it. I'm probably going to finish it tonight on stream or tomorrow.
Very good.
And also, I've been playing the new Binding of Isaac DLC some more, which that's just going to be burning in the background of my mental awareness sphere for the next 5 years. And also, I'm going to be playing the BlazBlue or Guilty Gear Strive beta tonight.
Very good.
That's me. Hey, Jace, what you got? Oh, not on stream now.
Oh, okay. I have been playing L.A. Noire.
Really?
Yeah, I went back because I had never finished it, and I wanted to know how it all ended, how it all wrapped up. A satisfying but also very unsatisfying conclusion to that game. But I played the whole thing. I made sure I got all the clues and the hints and all that stuff, and it was actually very good. I think, though, more than anything, and this happens anytime I play games that feature police in it, it reinforces a certain idea that I have about police officers. The main character is supposed to be this very good cop, but even when he is good, he is still bad. And then all the cops that surround him throughout the game are just horrible. One of them is a complete racist toward everyone. Like, and I get it. It takes place in like the late 1940s, so obviously that's going to be a factor. But that doesn't make it any less hard to swallow. So it was a really tough game for me to get through on that end. But I also love to death whodunits, detective stuff. If there was ever an L.A. Noire sequel, I would play it because I love that gameplay. I love that game style. I love clues and puzzles and all that stuff. So it was right up my alley, and I thank Rockstar for putting it out, but I also curse them for making me have to go through it. So yeah, L.A. Noire. I've also been dabbling a little in one mobile game, just one. I don't usually play mobile games. Yeah. I don't usually like them, but I picked up Clash of Clans again.
Is that because of me?
Not necessarily. I think I saw you playing it once, though, and I was like, I should play it again. And then recently I was like, let's get into it, and now I'm into it too much.
How far are you?
Is that anything? I still never played it, but you see its pictures everywhere, right?
Yeah.
So the funny thing about Clash of Clans is, like, so whenever Clash of Clans first came out, it was kind of the height of predatory mobile gaming and, and, like, just bad design made to make you want to spend money. But here's the thing. There's like two sliding things that have changed over the years. One, Clash of Clans has gotten a lot better as a free-to-play game, and that it doesn't push you as hard to want to spend money, although it still does, of course, it's a free-to-play game. But two, the game development has just gotten a lot worse. And the standard has gotten so low that at this point, where Clash of Clans is honestly above the low water mark where when it came out, which was like 2015, I want to say. Yeah, like back when the free mobile game market was becoming a serious thing, it was one of the worst games out there, and it sort of just improved over time.
Yeah.
That's a real, like, free-to-play Overton window. Like,
sorry, you know, 2012, but yes.
The culture moved, and it got less troubling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically.
You're 100% right.
It's one of those games where I played it for a while in college with some friends who I considered, like, you know, kind of douchebag bros types. And I associated it with those types of people for the longest time. And then I started seeing, like, you know, the peripheral of that. And I was like, okay, I guess it's not. But I still don't want to play it. But and now I'm back in. So here we are.
What town hall
yet? Clash of Clans yet again. What town hall am I at? I think I'm at level 5.
Baby.
So, yeah, I'm still a baby. I have my wizard tower, though, and I'm designing things and putting up walls, more walls. So yeah, it's been an interesting switch between LA Noir, and then when I get bored of LA Noir and climb into bed for the night, I pick up Clash of Clans for like an hour, and then I'm like, okay, that's it.
For comparison, so I can just contrast against Kami Jace, I'm currently about halfway through upgrading everything for Town Hall 10, and I still am baby.
Yeah.
They just released Town Hall 14, and I'm just like, I'm not going to be there for 2 years.
Yeah, it's gonna take a while, especially if you don't spend actual money to get there.
Yeah, I do buy the monthly gold pass because it does speed up upgrades a lot.
I refuse to spend money on a mobile game.
you're correct, Sue. No, see, I am Boo Boo the Fool, and I am aware of this.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break before we get into the news of the week. So stick around, listen to the ads that are definitely going to play, and we'll be right back with more show.
You creep through the lush forest, past a bubbling brook. Suddenly, a twig snaps behind you and you draw your sword.
Your neutron pistol shakes in your hand as you step into the abandoned starport. You try to ping the captain, but the comms are dead.
Then you see her, under the streetlight, a woman smoking a cigarette. Her sly smile reminds you of the witness.
She draws bullets in the dirt, chestnut whinnies you hightail it, but not before your arm tastes hot lead.
Many Realms is an actual play RPG podcast with short campaigns and a variety of systems. Where to next?
Fast and Furious, that's what the Street Writers podcast is. 10 minutes each week on writing, motivation, inspiration, and activation. With guests that range from Academy Award winners to convicts, all of whom will blow you away with tips and tricks to get your short story, screenplay, novel, play, comic book, or business presentation off the ground and kicking ass. Mark Bellucci and Dan Chichester are award mercenaries who have had plays and short stories published, films produced, and comic books authored for Marvel, in addition to copywriting for various ad agencies. No, it's not the boring, highfalutin writing class you suffered through in high school. It's a pure shot of creative adrenaline as we take writing off its high horse and bring it to the streets. Got 10 minutes? Then check out Street Writers and get writing.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back to the show. So, we've got news. A lot of people are in the news this week. we're going to be focusing on Sonic, who made the news a little bit more like Sega, I guess. And Valve, who was in the news like 3 times, but we're going to focus on 2 stories in particular. So, for the first one, recently on Twitter, the social media and influencer manager for Sonic the Hedgehog spoke up regarding Sega's prized Blue Hedgehog and fan content. Katie, also known as Mini Kitty, took to Twitter to state that Sega and those who control the Sonic name are generally okay with Sonic being used in art and development, so long as no profit is involved, usually. Mini Kitty went on to say that for legal reasons, they cannot promise that all content is okay and that outliers are being handled on a case-by-case basis, but their goal isn't to stifle everything.
That sounds pretty par for the course. So for anybody who doesn't know, there is a very proud, rich, long-running history on the internet reaching back to the late 90s of both fan games, fan comics, fan just about goddamn everything for Sonic very specifically. It's God, you could write dissertations on the production of the fan community for Sonic. And as far as I know, with very few exceptions, Sega has been completely openly accepting of this. Sega, I mean, there's an annual event that has been running since, I want to say 2002, I'm going to fact check myself on that, called Sages, or Sage. 20th anniversary is this year, since 2001. It's the Sonic Amateur Games Expo, which is it's essentially a bunch of people sign up and they say, hey, I made a Sonic fan game this year, come take a look and play it. And it's just a website where they demonstrate every fan game that wants to make itself a part of this expo. Good, that's bad, incredible. Ugly, God help them. If they submitted it, it's a Sonic game and it runs, it's going to be a part of Sages. And it's something that has been wholly embraced by the community. I don't know if Sega has actually ever directly discussed it, but at the very least, you know, it's been around for 20 years. They know about it. And a few of the games that have come from that, a few of the developers have gone on to create actual Sonic games. Christian Whitehead, Taxman, who was a Sega fan game community developer for years, was brought on to make the mobile port for Sonic 2 and Sonic CD before, of course, he was allowed by the higher-ups at Sega to make his own Sonic game, which you may know as Sonic Mania.
Yes. Very, very true. Very good history lesson. Would you agree, Christian?
I sure would, yeah. And there's a lot of interesting history tied up in the Sonic brand. So it really is heartening to me to see that Sega, if not embracing that, is at least willing to tolerate it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting to me. It's hard to overstate the absolute breadth of the cultural impact of Sonic the Hedgehog. You know, Sonic now you may think of as just like kind of a down on his luck mascot for a company that has some success in areas and absolute tragedy in others with their hardware. I mean, I say hardware, their console hardware, not their arcade hardware, obviously. But like, in the 90s, Sonic was bigger than Mario. He was like he was one of the first video, I think he was the first video game character to be flown at the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. It was either Mario or Pikachu. Right. But like that's the level we're talking about. Like it was some like, I want to say almost like Beatles level shit. Like, and if you knew pop culture in the 90s, you probably knew Mortal Kombat, you probably knew Sonic the Hedgehog. And so, like, seeing Sega continue to embrace this and continue to embrace just the cultural impact of Sonic and allow this to happen, because to be clear, they are allowing this to happen. They are under no obligation to allow these fan games to exist. And the exceptions are more than likely stuff that is either misrepresenting itself, like saying that it somehow is an official game, or does something that makes Sonic look bad. I imagine Sonic Dreams Collection is probably about the most extreme you can go without potentially getting taken down by Sega.
I was so hoping you'd mention the Sonic Dreams Collection. That's a wild piece of art.
Sonic Dreams Collection is a wild piece of art. It's also so clearly a parody that I don't think Sega would come after it. And the funny thing is, I think Sonic Dreams Collection might be the most copyright valid fan game that's ever been made, because it's very clearly parody. It doesn't present itself directly as parody, but I think it would say it's one of the only fan games I can think of off the top of my head that would actually be able to make a valid case for being a parody rather than just a straight up fan game.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, it almost feels like it falls under fair use. It's so out there. Yeah.
It's right. I would say it's transformative to the point of parody.
Very cool. Very cool.
Great. Speaking on the other side of this coin. Oh no.
Yeah.
Yeah. You picked some good ones there, Jace. Nintendo of America's legal team. Well, hold on. Nintendo of America's legal team, with the use of a mass DMCA takedown, took down a total of 379 fan games from the gaming website and hosting service GameJolt in December 2020. Nintendo seems to have a streak of taking down their fan and going against fans when it comes to their IPs. I just realized these are probably a part of the same story, right?
They are. And I guess the reason why I kind of mashed them together is because when most fans, at least in my opinion, I think of like the old school video games, aside from like Atari's, they probably go towards the Nintendo and the Sega Genesis, right, which were both kind of vying for people's attention at the same time. And you have these two mascots, you have Mario and you have Sonic, but you don't see, and you're not allowed to see, according to Nintendo, many Mario fan games. And I think it's interesting to kind of pit the two against each other. Sega, who has become this kind of giant in their own way, and Nintendo, who was just a giant, and how they approach their own IPs. Christian, anything?
Yeah, I hesitate to go to bat for Nintendo here, because to say that they are draconian in their use of copyright law would be, you know, to really say the least. Mm-hmm. Nintendo really throws its corporate weight around in the legal world. But I did think that it was interesting researching this a bit, that the main thing that they seemed to take exception to here was the use of advertising banners and money raising by the individuals who had either the individuals who had created the game or Gaming Jolt, the website on which the games were being hosted, which I thought was interesting, because that's actually the same grounds that the Sonic representative used. She had explained, particularly in kind of, there's a lot of gray areas here, of course. And one of the gray areas that she talked about was areas where fans who created games were soliciting donations related to their game. And so that was kind of a gray area that Sega would need to take on a case-by-case basis. But really what much of this came down to in both camps, Nintendo and Sega, was ad revenue being gained outside of the company setting.
That's an interesting take. For me, at least, I'm kind of reading between the lines in Mini Kitty's statement, in that she explicitly doesn't say that you shouldn't do that. She very explicitly says that is a gray area. And whenever an official representative says something is a gray area, for me, that's a license to just fucking go all out. Like, it would be pretty easy for them to put their foot down and say, hey, if you're collecting donations for something, probably not okay. Now, it's possible that Mini Kitty just didn't have the clarification from legal or whatever, and she was just sort of like, I'm gonna say something now instead of waiting for clearance. But in my eyes, that's like, I'm reading between the lines there. I'm going, well, they didn't say no, which, for, you know, it's one thing if your parent doesn't say no to something, it's another thing if a corporate legal entity or representative thereof doesn't say no to something. In that case, I consider that borderline tacit approval.
That's a good point, and it's not one that I had considered. I was taking the statements at face value, but that's a really good point. And Nintendo certainly has a history of taking down content that is not making any ad revenue as well.
Yeah.
Like, that's the argument made in this case, but that has not historically been the case. And Sega has historically been more open to fan games.
The big thing thing that comes to mind is, not very long before Super Mario was it Super Mario 30 or whatever, for Super Mario 35 came out, there was a Battle Royale Mario game that was actually made by a fan. It was just
really
it was Super Mario Brothers Battle Royale. It released like 3 months before they announced Super Mario 35, before they announced, to be clear, and like 2 days after this guy released it, he got DMCA'd by Nintendo and was cease and desisted, and he ended up putting up a copyright-free version of it called Super Copyright Infringement or something. But anyway, Nintendo has made it clear that fan games, even if they don't necessarily make money off of them, they're liable to get slapped down at any time. Sega, that's not the case.
Yeah, and I wouldn't be quite as bummed about Nintendo's intensity on takedown notices if they consistently put out content that was being hosted at places. So famously, they had ROM sites taken down a couple of years back, which I fully understand from a corporate position. It's problematic to have your content running around being able to be freely downloaded.
Yeah.
But when you aren't making it available yourself and it's out of print, it enters into this unfortunate space where you can be removing history from the internet for some kind of nebulous promise of maybe making it available someday once again.
Yeah. And obviously you have no way of knowing this. We've discussed copyright quite a few times on the show.
Of course.
And a regular theme that does come up is there's a difference between what is legal and what you should do. In this case, of course, Nintendo is legally within their rights to do that. But yes. I can only apply the come on bro clause,
right.
Which is like, you do that and you're like, all right, you're right, but come on, bro.
Yeah. That's a valuable distinction to be made in a lot of areas of life, really.
RIP MU Paradise. We miss you. Although I know MU Paradise is still up, but you know, you probably can't end or
a pale shadow of what it once was.
Yeah.
There are certain websites that I could have sworn have been taken down like 3 or 4 times, but then I look them up and it's like, well, they're just chugging along.
It is worth noting that Game Jolt has a few, if not a few more than what I can tell so far, of some fan games that look to still be Mario themed, Nintendo themed in some way, shape, or form. So maybe, you know, Nintendo took a glance at most of these games and said take them down and hasn't come back, and maybe next December we'll be hearing about them again. All right, so we've got Nintendo out of the way. Let's switch to a different kind of company here, and we're going to switch over to Valve, as we said.
And also,
Valve,
sorry, before one more thing, I just wanted to clarify. The Nintendo story is like from January of this year.
Yes.
It just sort of provides a contrast to the Sega story.
Absolutely.
Just so somebody isn't like, well, wait a minute, that happened back in January. Why are they talking about that? We're just contrasting.
You know what this show is. It's compare and contrast.
We talk about all the hot headlines from 4 months ago.
January 2021. It might as well be January 1921.
Ha ha.
You're right. You're right about that, though. Valve, listen up. We're going to talk about you. I hope you're ready, Gabe Newell. I know you listen. The developer of a VR sex game called Holodex with 3 X's has been denied for the third time from the Steam marketplace. Holodex does seem to be available through their own Patreon and on itch.io, but has had trouble getting onto. Getting on Steam for various reasons. After submitting a nudity-free version, a version full of nudity, and a final version called Holodex Home, which included some interactive story, quote-unquote, and gameplay elements, Steam shot back briefly with what the developer calls, quote, boilerplate explanations about pornography not being allowed on Steam. Critics and journalists point out, however, that despite Steam and Valve's excuses, other games that break the rules, like no sexually explicit images of real people, still exist on the Steam marketplace. So in addition to kind of maybe ripping Steam apart a little for their strange rule criteria that some people can get across and other people can't, I also wanted to kind of discuss where do we personally kind of draw the line at sex in video games, right? So we have sexual media in general. We have sex in movies, We have like implied sex in video games, like in Grand Theft Auto, if you pick up a prostitute or something like that, or just if the character has a sexual relations with the character, a la Dragon Age. So like, is there a line to be drawn? Does sex belong in video games? And is there a right way to do it? And I don't know. Christian, why don't we start with you?
This is kind of an interesting question. Like on a personal level, like as something of, you know, I've been playing games for a long time. So, you know, when I first started playing, it was all like ludicrous pixel art, you know, more the abstraction of the human form than anything else. And so, you know, this was not really a question that really came into my mind back then. And you know, being something of a prude myself, perhaps, like, you know, I haven't ever seen like a sexual scene in a game that I'm like, oh yeah, you know, like this is really rocking or something, you know, what have you.
Sure.
But like, of course sex belongs in games. Like it's the most significant new art form of the late 20th century. Mm. Like the idea that sex doesn't belong in film or sex doesn't belong in novels would be ridiculous on its face.
Sure.
So, you know, the idea that sex doesn't belong in games is not an idea that I think holds a lot of water. That said, where do we draw the line? I would be inclined to say exploitation. Like one of the things that I thought was kind of interesting about this Holodex example was how much the creators of it had been working with sex workers and I want to say, don't quote me on this, but I want to say adult film stars to really kind of get across how they wanted to be presented in this medium.
Yeah.
And I thought that was pretty much an ideal scenario. Like that's as non-exploitative as it gets. Like that's a really key part of the human experience and folks are being consulted on how they want to be presented. So, you know, it's very hard to understand where Valve is coming from on this.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been meaning to say that as a God-fearing Baptist man myself, I do not want to witness or even entertain the idea of any sort of pornographic imagery or messages within my video games entertainment. Anyway, I was playing Manhunt 2 the other day where I chopped another man's head open with an axe, and that was a damn good time. Listen...
America in a quote right here.
What's the fucking point? Listen, so there's two ways you can approach this. First of all, the idea of whether or not sex belongs in video games, no fucking doubt. It's an art form. You can start getting into the are video games art. Video games can be art. And even if video games are art, who fucking cares? It's sex, man. Like people do that.
Yeah, you're right.
I'd argue there's more place for sex in video games than there is violence for video games. I mean, what is inflicting injury upon another person more acceptable than inflicting pleasure upon another person? But also, there is another aspect to this, which I feel like is a little more... Okay, on its surface, it sounds obvious. The way I'm going to phrase it is going to sound super obvious. Should pornography be allowed in the same marketplaces as non-pornographic art? Is a more interesting delineation to draw, which at that point you start asking questions of, well, what is porn? What isn't porn? Is an eroge visual novel porn because it has sex scenes? Some people would argue yes. Some people would argue no. And so the idea that Valve is and to sort of get into where you draw the line, it feels to me like Valve isn't explicitly trying to ban sex in games. They're trying to ban porn. And that is such a weird thing to try to do. And they've essentially done that for years and years. Any game that would more or less get an AO rating from the ESRB, it wouldn't be allowed on Steam. And a few years back, I want to say it was back in 2018 or 2019, they actually flipped a switch and said, you know what, fuck it. Adult games are allowed on Steam. Go goddamn hog wild. And then in the past year, they've been walking it back. They opened a floodgate and they were like, what have we done? And to be clear, the types of pornographic games that have been allowed on Steam, some of them have been great. a lot of them have been really trash. And I'm not just talking about from like a sex standpoint. I'm just talking about like a quality standpoint. And you're also getting games that are like openly, that are openly exploitative. There's, I can't think of the name of the game off the top of my head, but a couple months ago, there was a game that was not allowed on Steam that was essentially just a pickup game. Like, it was, it was a game that used real FMV, and you essentially were shown an FMV and were told, like, how do you pick up this chick? And it was, like, the most, like, alpha male, gross-ass bullshit stuff.
Yeah, that was much darker.
Yeah. And while I can understand Valve would want to content moderate that, and I personally find that kind of stuff incredibly objectionable, you have to start asking questions like, is Valve in a position where they should be able to moderate that? If they allow or disallow one thing, when they, where do they have to draw the line on other stuff? And to me, this feels like Valve is trying to go, okay, we, if we're going to draw the line on one thing, we need to draw the line on another thing.
Yeah.
And it feels like Valve is trying to take a really shotgun approach to their moderation of adult content. And again, I feel like this is more of a debate of what is or isn't adult content and what types of adult content should be allowed. Should adult content be found objectionable? What kind of adult content should we find objectionable? And it feels to me like Valve doesn't want to have that conversation. I think Valve just sort of wants to go, all right, anything that is above X arbitrary line that we set in the sand is too much. They still theoretically allow adult games, to be clear. Any games that have already been approved on Steam, as far as I know, haven't been removed. But games that they're approving going forward, they've been pulling back on what they allow on Steam. And it feels like this gradual pulling back of what they're allowing is sort of an abdication of responsibility to me. It feels like they're not willing to sit down and go, do we want to allow this? Do we not want to allow this? And they're taking a shotgun approach to it. And that's kind of the that's kind of been the Steam MO basically since like 2012.
Yeah,
they just sort of take a shotgun approach to moderation and then damn the consequences. And there's a lot of reasons Steam is infamous among developers for that. I don't really have a point to where I was going on this, but I feel like the ultimate message is, once again, we have a case of Steam advocating responsibility, and it's kind of bullshit.
Yeah, Valve. A little bit.
Can I just add the first entry in the series, and I'm not going to name the series, just lest we inadvertently advertise it, but the series of pickup artist games, the first entry of it is actually still on Steam, bafflingly. And it is advertised as now including features from the third entry, which Valve opted to delist. So it seems like, I don't know, creepy MRA pickup artist game managed to get around these restrictions, again, which probably speaks to the weakness of the shotgun approach.
Yep. And it also speaks to the weakness of just how Valve does things. They go from a laissez-faire approach to a way too restrictive approach, and they have no nuance. That's the biggest problem with Steam. There's no goddamn nuance.
Yeah,
like they tried to do the green list.
Yes, that's the green light or something
green
like
light,
that.
Yeah.
That's they tried to do where a lot of these problems come in.
Yeah, green light was literally if you got X amount of pre-sales or something, or you got X amount of like thumbs up or wish lists on a game, it just got added to Steam, and there was no moderation behind that beyond if you hit certain arbitrary checkpoints, you got added to Steam. And then Valve shut down that project because they were like, okay, well, this laissez-faire program didn't work. Let's try another laissez-faire approach, which is just anybody who pays us enough money. And then there was an outcry for that because Steam became inaccessible even more. And it, God, I could go on and on about my frustrations with Valve and Steam.
They try, though. And not to say that it's good that they try or it's bad that they try, but they really try to figure out where how can I put it? They're trying to fit themselves into a certain corner, I guess, and they're constantly putting themselves into different boxes. Like, is this one going to work? Nope. Okay, let's try the next one. Is this one going to work? Nope. Okay, let's try this one. And so far, they've figured out something that kind of works, right? You have this system where you submit the game and they look at it, and I guess they might have a team, and that team might determine, not today's Satan. But then, you know, you get a different member of the team the next day and they're like, yeah, sure, whatever.
Yeah.
So it's very, as you say, laissez-faire. It's not, it needs to be better. I think most people know where I stand on if there should be sex in video games. I'm pretty sex positive on everything that I do.
Gross.
I'm pretty hey, you shut your mouth. I am pretty sure that I've plugged either advertently or inadvertently the game Strange Flesh. I do not recommend looking it up if you are kind of faint of heart or if you're homophobic. It is a very interesting, very extremely homoerotic beat 'em up game. It plays very well as a beat 'em up game, but also there are some pretty explicit scenes in there. So, you know, check it out or don't. This is not an endorsement or a rebuke. It's just a thing that's out there. That being said, Valve put out game sometime, right?
Once upon a time, Valve was a developer.
And in fact, they may be considering putting one of their new releases on consoles. According to a question and answer session held at a high school assembly, students asked Gabe Newell if any new games would be put on the consoles in the future, or if they're staying all PC side. Newell only shared that we will, quote, get a better idea of that by the end of the year, end quote. The last game to release on consoles from Valve was Counter-Strike Global Offensive for PS3 and Xbox 360 in 2012. The most well-known release for console, however, is the Orange Box, which included Half-Life 2, Team Fortress 2, and Portal 2 in one bundle, and Team Fortress 2 never got goddamn patched on the PlayStation 3. It is still in its vanilla state, and I am forever going to be upset about how fucking abused Team Fortress got on consoles. Yeah. I am so
mad.
Can
you still play it online with people?
You can.
Oh, cool.
So mad.
That's kind of a weird time capsule, isn't it?
It is, actually. No, it's actually weird. If you go back and play Team Fortress 2 on the Xbox 360, it's just vanilla Team Fortress. They didn't update it at all.
That's legit the only version I've played. I'm sorry, go on.
I kind of commend Steam for keeping it going, at least, because I feel like most people would have shut it down by now.
Yeah.
It's almost 10 years, so...
I want to say that TF2 on... Xbox Live used local hosting, so like there was a host and just everybody ran off that. So
that makes
technically
sense.
It can run forever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what do we think Valve is going to put on there on consoles? Huh?
Half-Life Alyx is coming to PS5 to me.
Yeah, what I was considering.
That's 100% a called shot. Half-Life Alyx for PS5. They've already announced PSVR is coming to PS5. That's not news. So. When PSVR comes out for PS5, like an actual PS5 dedicated PSVR, technically you can do PSVR on PS5 already, but it's only PS4 games.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So whenever the dedicated PSVR comes out for PS5, I think Half-Life Alyx, if not a PSVR launch title, is going to be early in the lineup.
Yeah, but you're right.
I agree.
Outside of that, I honestly can't see any other Valve games coming to console unless, and, you know, they've obviously teased it several times. If Half-Life 3 actually happens at some point, it'll almost certainly come to console. That's what I think.
Hmm.
The one fly in that ointment is that this Gabe Newell interview isn't the right word for it. This Gabe Q&A. Newell cameo appearance at a New Zealand school also saw him talking about the potential for a Valve home console, if memory serves. he sort of obliquely alluded to, like, you'll know more about it by the end of the year.
Oh, God, is this Steam Machines round two?
Yeah, let's get more Steam Machines, you know?
Because that went so well last time. It was completely sensical, and nobody got confused about what they were trying to accomplish.
Look, anybody can build a home video game console. Yeah, you know, Amazon's in the market, Google's in the market, Valve is in the market.
Anybody can build 20 different versions of a single console and try to pretend they're all the same thing. Not confusing at all.
Yeah. So that does make me wonder. That's kind of the only wrinkle for a Half-Life 3. That were Valve to do that, I could see them designing Half-Life 3 as kind of a system seller. I think it would be a deeply misguided decision, but I think it. I can see it happening.
Here's the thing. I think I could see Valve pulling it off. That's the thing.
Yeah, I was going to say, I could see them pulling it off, but I also think they would alienate a lot of people who seem to be kind of shying away from the kind of digital market and want more physical media. Yeah. So I am skeptical that Steam, Valve, and overall Gabe Newell would be willing to make a physical CD version of a Valve platform, console.
What I want from Valve, I think they could do this. They just have to fucking sit down and actually do it. I want a legitimate, concentrated, concerted effort at a Steam console. I think they could do it. They've made the Valve Index. They've proven that they can make successful hardware that sticks around. They, to a lesser degree, they made the remotes. You know, the remotes they discontinued, but they're still a fucking good remote. Like, Valve has shown they can make hardware and have it sell. I think that if they made a, like, $500 box that played pretty much every Steam game if they could get it and made it essentially a Steam machine, but, like, actually with some cohesion behind it, I think they could have a killer hardware on their hands.
It could give Epic a run for their money, too.
True.
Then we might get an Epic box.
Oh, Lord. I can't handle it.
It's called the PlayStation 4. the PlayStation 5. Ha, ha, ha.
Perfect. All right. Wow. That's the news for this week. And it's time to wrap it up. And we've got to wrap it up right now. So,
all right. Good night. Thank you all very much for listening.
No, shut up. You know how this goes. We move toward the end of the show by asking Christian to give our listeners a recommendation. Which game should they be playing or be on the lookout for?
I want to make a plug for Aerial Knights Never Yield, which is an indie game coming to certainly Switch. I want to say all major home console platforms in a week or two at the time of recording.
I'm pretty sure he just got PS5 confirmation.
So sweet.
I'm pretty sure it'll be on the PS5 store as well.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm still on the fence about what console I'm going to pick it up on, because I'd love 60 frames per second, and I'm not sure if that's exclusive to Xbox and PlayStation, or if I can get that on the Switch, but I also would like portable play. Maybe I'll get two copies. Who knows? It's really cool to see a game that, I don't know, like you get a lot of American games, but they don't feel like they reflect American culture to the degree that Aerial Knights Never Yield does. It's what is it? It's kind of like, what would you call it? I played the demo on the Switch. It's just brilliant. It's like a runner.
Yeah, it's an all runner platformer. I just watched the trailer for it. It looks really cool.
Yeah, the music in it's just wild. Yeah.
They call it a side scroller.
It looks adventure game. It almost looks like Bit Trip Runner by way of my friend Pedro.
Huh. Yeah, I could see that.
That's a good,
there's a pull for a you guys.
Yeah. That's a good mash. But it does look absolutely great. Aerial Knight is the developer and designer of the game. He's really cool. I follow him on Twitter.
Nice, I do too. he's great.
Check out Aerial Knights Never Yield, out in 5 days.
There you have it.
As of this recording. Paul, what are you telling people to play?
All right, I've got a cute one for you guys today. There's this little mobile dating sim that I picked up recently. It is called Tender Creature Comforts, spelled T-E-N-D-E-R, so it's said like the dating app. And it's essentially a dating sim that simulates Tinder, more or less. You're an alien that has visited a foreign planet, and you're there to date, baby. And essentially, you are signed up for a dating app that is very, very similar in UI to how Tinder works. And it's essentially a millennial swipe dating sim. You swipe left and right on various aliens and monsters. You sometimes automatically match with them. And then you talk to them and have chats with them in basically real time. Whenever you message people in the game, sometimes they respond right away. Sometimes they may not respond for a day. Sometimes you may never get a response. They may just, you match with somebody and then you never hear from them. A lot like Tinder in real life. And so you build these connections with these aliens and eventually you go on a date, which you schedule in real time. I'm a little iffy on the real time mechanic of it. It's kind of similar to Mystic Messenger, if you're familiar with that game, which is another popular messenger dating sim game. But yeah, it's a cute little game. It's on iOS and Android, I believe. Costs $4, so it's a premium game, not free to play. But, you know, $4 is a small price to pay. And yeah, it's really cute. There's some fun storytelling that's going on in it. And I strongly suggest that you check it out if you are interested in mobile dating sims.
Shoot, man, that sounds brilliant. I'm going to be picking that up as soon as I get off the show.
It's actually really adorable.
Hey, Jace, I've never played anything like that.
It's really great. Jace, what's your recommendation, man?
I am going to recommend Spirit Swap. Yes, lo-fi beats to match 3-2. It is cute, it is queer, it is black. And that fits every criteria. Yeah, that's correct. Oh, God bless. I'm cute. It's cute, it's queer, it's black. It's very good. It's got some very like nice, chill music, very nice, chill kind of gameplay. The story is just nice. It's just nice. It's got black people not suffering. It's nice. The characters look great, especially one of them who is just buff they he guy or they them person is just very, very fun. Very fun things happening in that. And it speaks to me entirely. So go check out Spirit Swap, please. It's on Kickstarter. You can support it still or share it. And follow along and be gay.
Nice. Yeah, this looks amazing. Apparently it has, it's focused on like Middle Eastern fantasy as well.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's got a very, very, as they say, diverse team.
Yeah. So why don't we see that more often?
Why don't we? Capitalism sucks. So as we move toward the finally to finish off this episode, please let us know where we can find you on the internet and if you have anything else to plug.
Oh, yes. Sorry. I was browsing the Kickstarter for Spirit Swap, which this is not the time for. But I'm really excited about this game now. as far as where I can be found, again, my name is Christian Skipper. You can find me on Twitter under the handle at Singin' Breakman. That's Singin' Breakman, because Singin' Breakman was taken when I signed up for Twitter. You can also find our podcast, Franchise Festival, on Twitter at franchise_fest. Or on any major podcast app. We've been publishing since January 2020, have quite a few episodes in the kitty. I do strongly recommend if you do look into that, don't be discouraged by the low sound quality of early episodes, because we really improve as it goes, as you'd expect from the first season of a show. Mm-hmm. That said, season 2 of Franchise Festival will be starting up on July 1st, 2021. And we're going to be covering the entirety of the Resident Evil franchise. So please be sure to join us.
Fantastic.
I will listen very closely to the Code Veronica episode.
I got a lot of thoughts on Code Veronica.
I'm sure you do.
Perfect. I love it. Paul, where do you live?
Well, biggest place I'm living, of course, is not Twitter, actually, because I'm still private, but at Paul's Rockin' Twit, as always, you can find me there. I do stream on a semi-regular basis, twitch.tv/Bonzi77. If you are listening to this podcast, there is a non-zero chance I may be streaming Resident Evil 8. In fact, as you listen to this, when the podcast comes out, if it doesn't come out at 4 a.m., I may actually be streaming right now, twitch.tv/Bonzi77. Finally, as always, you can find me. I do voice acting stuff over at the Vox's VoiceOver Nexus, where I voice a character in Let's Read Homestuck. Other than that, of course, I am here on a semi-regular basis. Feel free to hit me up at the Weekly Cooldown as well. I don't check that Twitter, but if Kami Jace has something interesting, he'll send it my way. That's all I got.
Yes. Very good, very good, very good. All right. As always, you can find me at Comic Jason Gaming on Twitter, and you can also find me as well on that same WK Cooldown Twitter. That is the Weekly Cooldown Twitter. Be sure to visit the Weekly Cooldown Facebook page. Visit WK Cooldown for more news and other episodes. Be sure to leave a review or comment on Apple Podcasts. Be sure to check out the links in the description, including, of course, our Humble Bundle for this week. And remember to support your favorite charities and support the show. Our logo and art is done by Corgian of Doghouse Esports. Follow him at DoghouseCorgian. That is Doghouse Corgian on Twitter. Our intro music is done by Riki. Follow Riki on Twitter at DogNoise. That's DOG_NOISE. That's all for the Weekly Cooldown. I'm Commie Jace.
I'm Paul Known Catholic Henderson.
I'm Christian Skipper.
And we'll see you next week. Thanks so much for listening.
Goodbye.